The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello, and welcome to Short Circuit, your podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeals. I'm your host, Anthony Sanders, director of the Center for Judicial Engagement at the Institute for Justice. As we often do on this show, we have a couple exciting attorneys ready to talk to you about a couple exciting cases. But first, I want to remind you of a couple even more exciting things on our sister podcast here at IJ. One is Deep Dive that we talked about a couple weeks ago. It is a podcast that investigates issues behind our cases here at IJ and where you can actually see, I mean with your eyes, IJ attorneys via YouTube. The other is another product of the Center for Judicial Engagement, and that is Bound by Oath, which we've been promoting on this show for a couple months now. And now finally, season two has arrived and episode one is already out. Episode two may be in your podcast feed by the time you're listening to this. Speaking of your podcast feed, if you are not subscribed to Bound by Oath, you should do that right now. You should stop what you're doing, go to your podcast app, search Bound by Oath. By the way, don't do this if you're driving. Do it once you're parked. But everyone else, search Bound by Oath, subscribe, and then you will get all the episodes of Bound by Oath. Last season, season one, our first season, we talked about the 14th Amendment. That was great. That was on the feed for Short Circuit. But like a little bird that has spread its wings, Bound by Oath is no longer subsidized by the Short Circuit feed. It doesn't need that anymore. But if you need to get Bound by Oath, you should go to its own feed, and then you have two feeds and all the judicial engagement you could ever want. The sister podcast, Bound by Oath, with John Ross and Anya Bidwell of IJ are going to knock your socks off by talking about all kinds of immunities that government officials enjoy when they violate your rights and what we can do about that. We're talking about federal immunities, qualified immunity, which of course has been big time in the news recently, prosecutorial immunity, the history behind civil rights acts, all that good stuff, Bound by Oath. Now, back here on Short Circuit, let's not delay our busy guests any longer. They are Patrick Giacomo and Ari Bargill, both attorneys at IJ. Welcome to both of you gentlemen.
Hey, thanks for having me, Anthony.
Thank you for having me, Anthony.
Of course, both of you. Well, Patrick, who's going to be up first, he just argued a case at the United States Supreme Court that's actually featured in episode one of Bound by Oath. So he's not going to say anything about that experience, although it's a fascinating story. You can go to Bound by Oath to hear all about that. But today, Patrick's going to talk, by the way, that case is Brownback versus King, if you want to look it up. We'll put a link up to it on this podcast just for fun. But what he's going to talk about today is a recent Third Circuit case concerning the Second Amendment, Folajar, I think I pronounced that correctly, versus Attorney General. It is not a Third Amendment case in the Second Circuit. It is a Third Circuit case on the Second Amendment. There actually is a Third Amendment case in the Second Circuit from 1982, Engblom versus Carey. I think it's just about the only Third Amendment case out there. And I guarantee the audience, if we do have a Third Circuit, a Third Amendment case, especially if it's in the Second Circuit, it will be featured on this podcast. That's not the case today. So, Patrick, tell us about the Second Amendment.
I will. I'll tell you the first case today is about the Second Amendment in the Third Circuit. And that's how we'll keep it straight. So, as Anthony mentioned, this case is called Folajtar versus Attorney General. And this is really a libertarian catnip of a case because you've got guns and you've got taxes. And the issue in this case is whether filing a false tax return can cost you your right to bear arms under the Second Amendment. This arises because there is a federal statute that says that if you are convicted of a crime that has a punishment of 1 year or more, you lose your Second Amendment rights. And just as a fun aside, the statute also extends this removal of the Second Amendment to a bunch of other categories, including drug addicts, people who are in the country illegally, and persons who have renounced their American citizenship. So this goes well beyond people who have committed a crime that is generally speaking referred to as a felony because of the punishment. But in this case, we're dealing with an as-applied challenge to this statute. A number of cases have challenged the statute's constitutionality facially, and all of those have failed in every circuit. And so now people are turning to an as-applied challenge to say, even if the statute might be constitutional under some circumstances, it's not constitutional when applied to me. And in this case, the argument goes that someone who is convicted of a federal tax crime, a crime that has nothing to do with any sort of violence or danger, shouldn't lose their Second Amendment rights because there's no relationship between the crime they committed and their use of a firearm. And this case really kind of sets up a foil between judicial engagement and non-engagement. So the two-judge majority in the Third Circuit, which covers Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and the Virgin Islands, essentially says, as long as a crime is serious, and it talks about seriousness and virtuousness, that's good enough to justify removing someone's Second Amendment rights for the rest of their life. And the way that the court goes about determining whether a crime is serious is just whether a legislature, Congress or state legislature, deems that crime a felony. And so that's the line that they draw. And they do pay lip service to the idea that there could be some rare circumstance where a felony is so far removed from anything related to the Second Amendment or its history that it would be unconstitutional to remove someone's rights for being convicted of that crime. But the court doesn't offer any examples, and the dissent makes a lot about this. And so the dissent, on the other hand, says that the Second Amendment can only be divested from someone who has committed a dangerous crime, something related to violence or the threat or possibility of violence. And so ultimately, this case delves deeply into the history of the Second Amendment and what sorts of things at the time of the founding states and the federal government considered potentially significant enough to remove someone's ability to own or possess firearms. And so in what turns out to be a pretty academic seeming and very long opinion from the Third Circuit, you have the majority talking about this general idea of virtuousness and any crime that would call into question your virtuousness as a citizen, the majority says, is sufficient to take away your rights under the Second Amendment. And that translates in modern times into the conviction for a felony. The dissent, on the other hand, says, if we look at what was actually happening at the time of the founding, the only things that would have justified restricting someone's rights to own or use a gun is something that would either be them actively being dangerous, like committing one of the traditional common law felonies, things like burglary, rape, murder, mayhem, but nothing like what we're talking about here, which is something related to filing a false tax return, because that has no impact whatsoever on an assessment of whether someone is safe to own or use a gun. And so there's a lot of back and forth on this issue. And ultimately, the dissent rests on the position that by allowing legislatures to dictate that any felony is sufficient to take someone's Second Amendment rights away, you run into a lot of issues. And the dissent points to a number of silly situations where someone could be convicted of a felony. For example, one that it gives is New Jersey makes it a felony for someone to take a bottle of ketchup in a grocery store, open it, and then put it back on the shelf. And the dissent
it
also
does sound pretty gross.
Sure, right. But do you lose your Second Amendment rights or any other amendment rights for having done it is the question that the dissent asks.
I suppose.
And as a matter of consistency, the dissent also points out that depending on what state you're in, adultery is either a felony, a misdemeanor, or not a crime at all. And so if someone commits adultery in Nebraska, they could then lose their Second Amendment rights in the Third Circuit, even though Pennsylvania doesn't treat adultery as a felony. I can't remember which states actually treat adultery one way or the other. And at the end of the day, obviously the majority prevails here. And so the rule in the Third Circuit now is if you commit a felony, you lose your Second Amendment rights. And maybe there could be a situation where we find a felony that's so far removed from the Second Amendment that there would be a constitutional issue. But willingly filing a false tax return is certainly within the ambit of seriousness. And therefore, the government is within its rights to deny you your Second Amendment rights for the rest of your life. And it owes you no obligation whatsoever to challenge that or assess your individual circumstances before doing so.
And Ari, what do you think about filing tax returns?
Well, I think they're generally a pain, but beyond that, I don't think failure to do that should mean that anyone should lose an expressly enumerated constitutional right. And I think the dissent here kind of touches on this, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me that you would lose for life a constitutionally protected right for something that doesn't really reflect any dangerousness on the part of the violator.
Big thing that I took away from this case, apart from the core Second Amendment issue, is there's a lot of, you know, using historical sources, and the dissent. I think one tough time that the dissent Judge Bibas had is. There are a lot of people have spoken on this issue before, but a lot of them were citing each other. Of course, which happens in a lot of things in law and academia. So he goes to the original source and says, well, that doesn't quite say what it says. And then someone cites that, and someone cites that. And some of these, by the way, are real, you know, big Second Amendment proponent scholars, like a number of canonical articles in the move to have the Second Amendment declared an individual right. But on this exact issue, they were a little scant. And so he does his best to try to move that aside, that clutter aside. But it seems like that's something that the majority was able to rest upon. It also seemed like there's been a lot already in the Third Circuit on this issue, and I couldn't really follow because I didn't go and read all the cases. What was cited when and exactly what the holdings were. But it was maybe unfortunate that this case came as the third or fourth case, it seems, in the Third Circuit and not the initial one.
Yeah, so the dissent, Judge Bibas, definitely goes through a lot of the original sources and in a very specific way goes through all the citations that the majority throws out there and actually bullet points them all, explains why they're either wrong or duplicative of another source that's wrong or something like that. And ultimately, he ends up resting significantly on research that was done by then Judge Barrett in the Seventh Circuit, where she wrote a dissent in another Second Amendment related case. But one of the things that's interesting, I think, about the way that the court, both sides, addressed the history here was going back and looking at, you know, in the early days of the United States, how felons were treated. And a lot of what the majority says is, you know, look, at the time of the founding, most felonies could be punished by death. The dissent responds, yes, that's true. And there's this concept of civil death that goes along with it, which is to say, you know, if we can take your life, we can take everything else in your life, including your rights. And so one is lesser included to the other. But the dissent points out, even though death was available to most felonies or many felonies, it wasn't often used. And he cites some sources that say in some period of time that only about two people a year were being put to death in the original in the states that were the colonies. And so that wasn't something that happened often. But then even on the point of civil death, he said that would end if you weren't put to death and were given some other punishment. Once the punishment was concluded, we allowed people to be folded back in and given their rights. And he cites all sorts of things about, you know, how important it is that once someone has paid their debt to society, they're able to regain entry into society in full and participate by, you know, holding public office or in this context, owning or possessing a firearm. But I think one of the things that wasn't mentioned that I had a question about myself was with the majority talking about felons being punishable or being able to be punished by death, it talks about juries being able to make these decisions. But at the time of the founding, jurors were aware of the consequences of their decisions when they convicted someone of a serious crime. And that's usually not the case anymore. Many states don't even allow jurors to know what the potential sentence of a crime is. And so there's a twofold issue here that's not addressed by either the majority or the dissent, which is one, do jurors understand when they convict someone of a felony that means that person will lose their Second Amendment rights and the right to vote and many, many other things? And two, the difference between one of those early cases in the country where the jurors convict someone of a felony is that putting someone to death or taking their property away is one of the punishments directly passed upon in the court case. And so there is this due process. Whereas here now in this context and many others, we have these statutory provisions that aren't actually part of a case. You don't have to be convicted and sentenced to lose your right under the Second Amendment. You just have to be convicted of a felony, and then by operation of statute, there are additional penalties that are foisted upon you. And so I think those are two things that historically might be interesting for someone to look at and see if there's some way to distinguish those early cases where felonies were treated one way and misdemeanors were treated another.
I think that also raises a point I had thought of, that in the modern age, impact of a felony often has to do with licensing. So whether it's your driver's license, your license to carry, your license to own a gun, which I know there isn't actually a license to own a gun issue in this case, but it's thought of in that way. Your license to earn for the right to earn a living in various occupations, those all can be impacted in a big way by having a felony or any kind of criminal record. And so it's a lot easier for the state to track and to punish in that way. Whereas at the founding, it was, well, okay, you would have this punishment, but there wasn't a lot of other ways that the government was, you know, tracking you or keeping tabs on you. I think the right to vote was probably for some people, not everyone, was about the only thing, you know, on parallel back then.
Yeah. And another thing that's interesting is the majority in the case, it starts getting into sort of policy explanations for why its decision makes more sense. And one of them is obviously anti-engagement, because they say, hey, one benefit to our way of deciding this case is that it's really easy to apply and courts don't actually have to engage in any way with the substance of the claims before them. They can just say felony, yes or no, check the box and move on. But when they're addressing this numerosity issue and dangerousness issue, they cite some studies that show, you know, recidivism rates of violent crimes are X, and then even people who go to jail for nonviolent crimes have some not insignificant chance of then committing violent crimes afterwards. And the point that the majority is trying to make is, if you can draw a distinction between one violent crime being indicative that the person will commit another, you can do the same thing, even if it's not as strong when the first crime is not a violent crime. But I think that what actually comes across, or what came across to me as a reader, was maybe the issue, the indicator, isn't that the person committed a nonviolent crime, but rather that they're being punished in such a way that, like Anthony said, it diminishes their ability to rejoin society in some serious ways. And so if you convict someone of a felony of any kind, and then you take away their right to work, their right to drive, their right to vote, their right to own certain things, it seems to me that the chances that they will turn to crime are much higher, because a lot of things they're doing have become crimes just by virtue of their felony. And B, their life is just much more difficult for those reasons, and they will turn to the darker side of things to make ends meet.
It's not that the type of person who committed that crime, it's that committing that crime turns them into that kind of person because of the retribution.
Sure. It's just a matter of incentives being skewed in such a way that, you know, where you might not have committed a violent crime before, now you will, because you're more desperate or you feel more excluded from society, and therefore the social contract is broken in that way. But any number of things along those lines could have that impact.
One final point I found was interesting in early in the majority's opinion, they cite Blackstone, William Blackstone, the 18th century jurist, and talk about how common felonies were in England at the time of the founding. And they say, Blackstone writes that, and this is, they're trying to beef up their argument with this. Blackstone writes that no less than 160 offenses have been declared by Act of Parliament to be felonies. I mean, if you read anything that Mike Chase has written, and who wrote the book How to Become a Federal Criminal, 160 is nothing. And that's like a libertarian utopia if there's only 160 felonies out there. So the fact that, you know, there were all these felonies back then, and, you know, you could lose your rights for committing them, I think that actually proves the opposite point.
Yeah, I actually wrote in the margin next to that, this isn't making the point you think it is, because the trajectory of that portion of the opinion starts out by saying, traditionally at common law, there were 9 felonies, and then it lists them, and they're all the things that you'd think of, which, you know, rape, murder, burglary, things like that. And then it gets to Blackstone saying now there are 160. And now their point is, look, today it's ubiquitous. Everyone can commit a felony. We can all be felons. And so I don't see how that supports their point that should be a much weaker case to deny someone additional rights because they've committed a felony, now that we live in a world where there are thousands and thousands of felonies that can be assessed on you by the state or the federal government.
Well, let's move now from one fundamental right, the right to keep and bear arms, to another in the First Amendment, the right to speak. And this isn't a right to speak about guns. This is a right to speak about puppies. Who could disagree with the right to speak about puppies? So there's an IJ case that just came out in the Fifth Circuit about the right to speak about puppies. Now, disclaimer, this is an Institute for Justice litigated case. We don't always talk about cases, as regular listeners know, of the Institute for Justice on this podcast. But you know what? We litigate some darn important cases out there. And this is one of the most important circuit court opinions from the last couple of weeks. So we're going to talk about it. It's Hines versus Quillivan. And it has to do with our old friend, our client, Ron Hines. So Ari, tell us about Ron and what he's trying to do.
Thank you, Anthony. Well, Ron is, Dr. Hines, I should say, is trying to do the same thing that he's been trying to do since about 2015 or a little bit before. So the decision is Hines v. Quillivan, which you said, but this is actually what we're calling Hines 2. And so I think in order to understand Hines 2, we should at a minimum understand Hines 1 and a couple of the intervening events and decisions that have taken place in between Hines 1 and Hines 2. So if you'll indulge me, Anthony, I'd like to give a brief sort of 5-year recent history of the First Amendment, particularly in the Fifth Circuit.
Take it away.
Great. Well, beginning with what we're calling Hines 1. That is of course, another IJ case on behalf of Dr. Ron Hines, involving much the same topic. State of Texas has a Veterinary Practices Act, which says that anybody who wants to provide any veterinary care needs to, at first or before they provide any such care, physically examine the animal or its surrounding premises. Well, Dr. Hines was providing veterinary telemedicine from his home. He was reaching people all over the world, many of whom didn't even have access to any veterinary care whatsoever. And his complaint was, all I'm doing is engaging in speech. And if what you're telling me is that it's illegal because, you know, the Veterinary Practices Act requires me to examine the animal first, then that would be an unconstitutional burden on my speech. And IJ brought this case in about 2013, I believe, and the Fifth Circuit decided it in 2015. And there the court applied something called the professional speech doctrine. It is a now discredited sort of area of the First Amendment. But essentially what the court concluded was, you know, Dr. Hines, this is merely an incidental burden on speech. The legislature can regulate veterinary practice. And to the extent the scope of that practice subsumes some speech within it, so be it. And the First Amendment is not triggered. And all that applies is traditional rational basis review, which longtime listeners of the Short Circuit podcast might recognize as a highly deferential form of analysis. The professional speech doctrine is grounded in a concurrence from Justice White in the Lowe v. SEC case from 1985. And really quickly, in a nutshell, the idea behind that is that an occupational license or professional regulation that burdens speech should not be analyzed under the First Amendment if it's a generally applicable regulation and is seemingly content neutral. And that's really the origin of the so-called professional speech doctrine. The U.S. Supreme Court never really recognized its legitimacy. And one of the major flaws with the doctrine is that it fundamentally misunderstands, for one thing, what it means for something to be content neutral. In Dr. Hines' case, for example, the question of whether the Veterinary Practice Act applied to him depended entirely on what he said. That is essentially a perfect example of a content-based restriction, and it should have been viewed as such by the court, and the First Amendment should have applied. So fast forward a few years, and the U.S. Supreme Court again, or I shouldn't say again, but the U.S. Supreme Court actually considers the question of whether or not there is even such a thing as the professional speech doctrine. And this is in 2018 in the Nifla v. Becerra case. And the Supreme Court unequivocally rejects the professional speech doctrine. The court really recognized something that IJ has been really hammering in its cases over the years. And that is that as long as there is such a thing as the professional speech doctrine, if the government wants to regulate speech, all it needs to do is just create an occupational license or a professional regulation, and then say that the speech is merely incidental to that regulation. And the result of that, of course, is that the government can create classes of people who can and cannot speak about certain things based on whether or not they have certain government permission slips. And the court in IFLA, as I said, rejects that and announces that, you know, speech is speech. It doesn't matter the context in which that speech arises. If people are speaking, that triggers First Amendment protections. And if people are engaging in conduct, then perhaps a different type of review would apply. And that's important because what it means is that if Dr. Hines had brought his legal challenge after the NIFLA decision had been decided, it likely would have turned out a different way. And we know that because the Fifth Circuit expressly admitted as much in another IJ case, Visalign v. Tracy, from earlier this year. Without getting too deep into the details of the Visalign case, essentially what the court there said is, you know, we applied the professional speech doctrine in the Hines case in 2015. The U.S. Supreme Court has just told us that that's wrong. And so now we're going to treat speech as speech. And the only thing that really matters is whether a given regulation implicates speech, First Amendment applies, or doesn't, and maybe rational basis review will apply. And that, of course, precedes the Hines 2 case that we're here to talk about. And in Hines 2, the court there made not short shrift of, but didn't devote too much discussion to the First Amendment claim because it was such an easy question by then. The court said, you know, we decided Hines 1 in 2015. We had Visalign in this circuit earlier this year. And we had NIFLA from the U.S. Supreme Court just a couple years before in 2018. And at this stage, it's pretty clear. We're bound by Visalign. We're bound by NIFLA. There is no such thing as the professional speech doctrine. And so to the extent that all Dr. Hines is doing is discussing, as you said, Anthony, puppies with his clients, then if the government wants to regulate that, it's going to trigger First Amendment scrutiny. The court remanded the case for additional fact-finding on sort of the scope of Dr. Hines' practice to see whether he's engaged only in speech or if there is some conduct component to it that might warrant a different type of review. But that's the long and short of it. And this marks a really long effort on the part of the Institute for Justice to, oddly enough, get courts to recognize that speech is speech. A handful of other circuits have in that sort of 5-year period that we're talking about, also handed down decisions that echo the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in NIFLA and have recognized that the quote-unquote professional speech doctrine is a dead letter in the federal courts. And that means that people like Dr. Hines are able to continue or should be able to continue offering basic advice over the internet and in person for money to paying clients.
Patrick, do you like to speak and have that protected in your practice?
Yeah, I would. And I thought, you know, it's one of those things that most people don't realize that you need to fight for to begin with. And you know, luckily we have the opportunity at IJ to fight those fights on behalf of people who might not even realize the constitutional peril that they're in. But a case like this one is really highlighted by the circumstances we find ourselves in now as we sit and look at each other through computers because of COVID. And the importance of something like telemedicine has been zoomed in on because of the circumstances that this disease has created. And it really shows you the sorts of terrible regulations that exist. And not only do those violate the Constitution in many ways, but they actually hurt real people. Because if you're prohibited from doing what Dr. Hines was doing, then what do you do in a situation like this where he's not going to come out to your property because people are supposed to be staying away from each other? And, you know, IJ, this has really revealed the enormous flaws in a number of regulatory policies that IJ has been fighting without any regard to COVID. And then another one of those is certificates of need. But this case is a great step forward for speech in general, and everybody should be excited about it.
Yeah, on that note, we have a number of animals at our house. And so when we brought them to the vet over the last few months, we meet the vet outside, they bring them in, we can't go in with the animal. I mean, it's fine because we have a relationship with our vet, but imagine if it was the first time that we were visiting, you can't go back there with your dog. And maybe you don't need the physical examination, you just need some kind of consultation or to show the vet over the video something that's wrong with your dog or your animal. You can't do that in Texas. But you can, so this is another aspect of the case I'd like Ari to address. You can do that if you're a doctor now, because just in 2017, the state changed the law to say that telemedicine essentially is okay for humans, but it's not okay for animals. So one part of this decision that was not so good for Dr. Hines was the rational basis challenge, where they brought up that disparity. Now, there was a rational basis challenge in the Hines 1, but this disparity didn't exist back then because it was only passed in 2017. So the argument is, look, a doctor can talk to someone about their maladies without having seen them before, but can't talk to a pet owner about the pet's maladies. And so what the pet's health. So there's no rational basis for that distinction. And the court, and this is getting really incestuous, but the court interpreted another past IJ case that many of you may remember, our case about monks, Benedictine monks in Louisiana who made caskets and sold them to their parishioners. And there's a split between the majority and the dissent on whether that case meant that this case had a law that was irrational. So Ari, tell us a little bit about that angle.
Right. Well, what we're talking about here are Dr. Hines's equal protection claims. And in equal protection, what we're really talking about is whether or not the law is treating similarly situated people differently. And in Dr. Hines' first case, in Hines 1, Dr. Hines argued, unfortunately unsuccessfully, that he was being treated differently from veterinarians who operated brick-and-mortar facilities. The argument here in Hines 2, as you alluded to, Anthony, was whether Dr. Hines was being treated differently in a constitutionally meaningful way from those who provide traditional telemedicine to humans. And one of the fun aspects of this opinion, or I should say most interesting aspects of this opinion, involves the back and forth between the majority and the concurrence on what equal protection actually means and what the Fifth Circuit's prior decision in the St. Joseph's Abbey case really means vis-a-vis economic liberty and equal protection. And there's a lengthy discussion of the St. Joseph's Abbey case, really in both opinions. And the majority goes through and they say, look, in 2013, we decided the St. Joseph's Abbey case. And that was a case, as you mentioned, Anthony, where the monks of St. Joseph Abbey wanted to sell simple wooden caskets to the good people of Louisiana, except the state of Louisiana had a law on the books that said anybody who wants to sell caskets must either be a licensed funeral director or funeral home. And the monks challenged that, and they said that's irrational. All this is economic protectionism, and you know, that's not a legitimate government interest, which is what the core of the inquiry is in a rational basis case, is whether the government's regulation is rationally related to a legitimate government interest. And in response, in St. Joseph's Abbey, the government made a number of presented a number of purported justifications for its law. They said that this would be better for public health and safety. They said that there was a consumer protection angle to it. And of course, they argued that, yes, to a certain extent, we are protecting the funeral industry. And the court there said, look, you know, if you want to protect one industry from competition, that by itself isn't enough to satisfy the rational basis test. And then they considered the evidence presented by St. Joseph Abbey in order to determine whether the law, whether the plaintiffs there had rebutted any presumptions of constitutionality. And they concluded that, yes, they had, and that at the end of the day, all that remained was just naked economic protectionism, and that Institute for Justice attorneys had successfully adduced enough evidence in the court to illustrate that the two other justifications, consumer protection and public health and safety, were basically complete conjecture and totally fanciful, and the court agreed there. And the majority in this case, in Hines 2, says that's not what we have here. This is a little bit different from that case. It's not completely fanciful. It's reasonable for us to think that treating humans is different from treating animals. A human can tell you what their symptoms are. They know more about the human body, et cetera, et cetera. And the concurrence says, hey, if St. Joseph's Abbey means anything, it's that you can, if you're able to allege sufficient facts to rebut, you know, a reasonably plausible justification on the part of the government, your case can go forward. And it's not the role of the court to dismiss cases before plaintiffs actually get the opportunity to introduce the type of facts and evidence that the plaintiffs in the St. Joseph Abbey case were able to introduce in order to win that case. It really calls into question, and I think the concurrence gets into this, like what is the actual motion to dismiss standard supposed to decide? Because ultimately courts are deciding these issues on the merits. And the concurrence looks at the St. Joseph Abbey case and says, look, if all we're doing is scanning for plausible justifications so that we can dismiss cases, then we're actually not really allowing plaintiffs to introduce evidence rebutting the justifications like the St. Joseph Abbey case requires. So this obviously, you know, goes a lot to what we talk about with judicial engagement and the rational basis test and what the role is of the courts vis-a-vis some of these equal protection claims when we're dealing with quote-unquote non-fundamental rights. And I think it'll be interesting to watch and see what happens with this, because I don't think I certainly don't think that this is the last time that the motion to dismiss standard will butt up against at least IJ's interpretation of what the rational basis test ought to be.
No, and that's something that's plagued rational basis litigation for years, is how's the motion to dismiss, especially in the Twombly-Iqbal era, which the lawyers listening will nod their heads along with what that means. But basically, it's a little bit higher a standard for motion to dismiss than we used to have. And so when you already have the rational basis, what does that all mean? There's actually a article out there. We'll put a link up to it by our friend Tim Sandifer at the Goldwater Institute, who's dived into these issues. The quote from St. Joseph Abbey is, a hypothetical rationale, even post hoc, cannot be fantasy. But then, of course, that raises the question, what is fantasy? And I will let all of you fantasize about what that might be. But I'd like to thank our guests here today. I'd want you all to go check out our other podcasts. But in the meantime, I want everyone to get engaged.